good morning and welcome to The Bridge, Coast Community Radio's own weekly news magazine. I'm Kate Brister. As summer approaches and the school year wraps up, working parents of school-aged children must now consider how their children will be cared for without school. The cost of care can be prohibitively high for some families. Assistance is difficult to find. We'll hear comments from Susan Brown, President and CEO of child care provider Kids Company, and study author Judith Warner, a senior fellow for the Center for American Progress. Also in this edition, we'll hear about a new survey showing beekeeper colonies across the country are in decline. Bee populations have been spiraling downward over the last decade, the result of a number of factors, including parasitic mites and pesticides. Dr. Dewey Caron was the survey collector. He's an affiliate professor of horticulture at Oregon State University. This is The Bridge for the week of May 19th. The Warrenton-Hammond School Board voted unanimously last week to remove Native American symbolism from its school mascots. The Warrenton Grade School Braves will get a name change and the high school Warriors logo will be redesigned. Correspondent Tom Bonsi reports, the small coastal district is among the first to come into line with the new state policy.
Oregon school districts have until next summer to do away with Native American mascots and team names by order of the State Board of Education. The board determined that nicknames such as Braves, Indians, and Chieftains can be offensive and harm the learning environment for Native students. Oregon school districts have the option to seek the approval of a nearby tribe to keep a Native American-themed team name, but Warrenton Superintendent Mark Jeffrey recommended against that course.
This isn't a settled issue, and I don't want to put the district in a position where on short notice somewhere down the road we're just going to have to change again. This is, a good time for us to do it, and I think it's the right thing to do.
The decision to retire the grade school Braves mascot and remove a lance and feather from the Warriors logo attracted little controversy here. About a dozen other Oregon school districts with Native American mascots are negotiating their names as future and more often than not getting tribal support with conditions. I'm Tom Bonsi in Warrenton, Oregon.
Down the coast, the Reedsport School District is having a harder time. Reedsport's teams are named the Braves. This spring, the superintendent approached the Confederated tribes of Coos, Lower Umpqua, and Suslaw Indians and learned they objected to continued use of the mascot. But then the executive director of the Confederate Tribes of the Silas Indians wrote to say that the tribe was willing to work with the Reedsport District to reach an agreement that would meet the state's criteria for an exemption. Reedsport's interim superintendent Dan Forbes did not return several messages asking how the district would proceed, given that one tribe was supportive and another disliked the Braves mascot. The State Department of Education identified 12 other Oregon high schools using Braves, Indians, Chieftains, or Warriors as team names. Nearly all of them have reached out to the nearest federally recognized tribe to open negotiations to preserve their mascots under a process set up by the state board. As the school year comes to an end, working parents of school-aged kids are securing their child care plans for the summer. One of the toughest challenges working parents face is paying for child care, which can skyrocket when children aren't in school. Susan Brown, president of the Child Care Providers Kids Company, sees the extra burden families face when school is out.
It's much harder for families because when you're used to paying for before and after school care only, which is about 5 hours a day, to now needing to pay for 10 to 11 hours of care a day, you're looking at your cost for care doubling.
Brown says some families might decide not to put their kids in care at all. Only about 37% of children, 6 to 13 in Washington, are in licensed child care throughout the year. For working families, applying for financial assistance can be an option to help pay for the cost of care. However, a new report from the Center for American Progress shows assistance sometimes can be hard to apply for. Report author Judith Warner says the poorest families don't have the cushion of safety being middle class provides and can face trials at every turn to find assistance.
They're struggling with a level of logistical difficulty that goes so far beyond the just regular life stresses and strains that all working parents talk about
all the time.
According to the report, the average child care cost for an infant and four-year-old in Washington State is more than $22,000 a year. Brown says an unintended consequence of raising the minimum wage in Washington cities has been that some families no longer qualify for these child care subsidies, yet still live paycheck to paycheck.
I think that looking at what qualifies you for subsidies has to happen, especially with the minimum wages going up.
To find out more about child care options in Washington State, go to wachildcareaware.org. '21 may seem like a long time away, but Eugene City Manager John Reese wants the city to start budgeting for when it will host the Track and Field World Championships. Correspondent Rachel McDonald has more.
Reese wants the city to set aside $500,000 in anticipation of the 2021 Track and Field World Championships. It's the largest athletic event of that year and the first time it will be held in the United States.
Eugene will be introduced to hundreds of thousands of people around the world. And so the question I think for us is are there some things that we would like to do leading up to that and during that event that really showcase us as Eugene?
Reese says the city might want to highlight sustainability, transportation, youth programs, and recreation. This summer, Eugene is hosting the 2016 Track and Field Olympic Trials for the third time in a row. I'm Rachel McDonald in Eugene.
Hotel rooms are already going fast in Oregon and other states along the path of next year's solar eclipse. The solar eclipse on August 21st, 2017, will be the first in the mainland U.S. in almost four decades. Communities from Oregon to South Carolina are billing themselves as the best places to view the rare event. All are located within a 65-mile-wide path that will experience the total eclipse. Skies so dark, stars will be visible at midday. A national astronomy convention has reserved the largest hotel in Casper, Wyoming, in Hopkinsville, Kentucky. It boasts in the zone that will experience the longest duration of total eclipse at 2 minutes 41 seconds. Madras, Oregon is planning a solar fest with camping, music, and beer gardens. But before we start counting our tourists, let's take a look at summer travel on North Coast roads. The toll system on four Western Washington highways needs improvement. That's the summary of a state audit on the Transportation Department's toll division. If you've received a toll bill months late or been charged late fees before you knew you had a toll to pay, well, the state auditor's office says you're not the only one. But another issue with the audit is security. The report says the toll vendor hasn't met all industry security standards. Senior Performance Auditor Sahara Monahan says that means there is less assurance that payment info is secure.
If you've received a toll bill months late or at the wrong address, or if you've been charged late fees before you knew you had a toll to pay, the state auditor's office says you're not the only one. But another big issue in the audit is security. The report says the toll vendor hasn't met all industry security standards. Senior Performance Auditor Sahara Monahan says that means there's less assurance that payment info is secure.
Even if the agency complied with the requirements, there's always risk. What compliance with this requirement does is protect the confidentiality and security of customer payment information that provides people more assurance that their information is safe.
The toll division says it's on the way to addressing those issues. Patty Rubstello is the assistant secretary.
They've completed the certification at that highest level. They just need to submit now the final document. And, you know, I'll just note that, you know, we don't believe at any time this information has been, you know, at risk.
Her division also has plans to fix the other problems outlined in the audit. I'm Paige Browning, KUOW News.
The toll division says it's on the way to addressing those issues. Patty Rubestello is an assistant secretary.
they've completed the certification at that highest level, they just need to submit now the final document. And, you know, I'll just note that, you know, we don't believe at any time this information has been, you know, at risk.
Her division also has plans to fix the other problems outlined in the audit. Oh, I love that song, but poor Sammy. Drivers planning on cruising through the West at top speed won't be able to go through eastern Washington's Interstate 90 at 75. According to an announcement by the Washington Department of Transportation, the State Patrol, and the Washington State Traffic Commission. Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins has details.
In the video for Sammy Hagar's I Can't Drive 55, he wants to pass a slow-moving truck on a two-lane road with oncoming traffic. Republican State Senator Michael Baumgartner of Spokane just wants to get to Olympia a tad faster. That's why he tweeted he's disappointed at the decision to keep the speed limit on a 100-mile stretch of I-90 between the Spokane County line and the Columbia River Gorge at 70 miles an hour. And he's not the only one. The public liked the idea of boosting the speed limit in that area to 75, but Al Gilson with WashDOT says an analysis showed even a 5-mile-an-hour increase could lead to more serious injury and even fatal crashes.
We want to reduce collisions in this state rather than do anything to increase them.
In fact, Washington has a goal of eliminating traffic fatalities and serious injury collisions by 2030. The analysis showed the faster speed limit would save drivers about 5 minutes on that stretch of I-90, but could also cost an additional life each year in a fatal accident. Undeterred, Senator Baumgartner tweeted he'll pump some Sammy Hagar and reintroduce legislation next year to boost the speed limit. In the meantime, he said he was in Seattle going 20 miles an hour, listening to Hendrix, Crosstown Traffic. I'm Austin Jenkins in Olympia.
Maybe the answer is driverless cars. They're here among us. Driverless cars have made their way to the Evergreen State. Google is testing its fleet of driverless cars in Kirtland. The company chose the city as a testing ground because of its hilly terrain and wet road conditions much of the year. Kirkland Mayor Amy Whalen says she's excited about the prospect of autonomous cars.
Cars have only been around, you know, 120 years. Look what's happened in that 120 years. Think what's going to happen in the next 20. It's an exciting time to be involved in transportation.
Kirkland was the third city in the United States to be chosen for driverless car testing. The city has a close relationship with Google, which employs more than 1,000 people in Kirkland and recently expanded its campus there. The Internet's company's pilot project in Kirkland also could be a testing ground for regulations on the industry. For instance, in the future, it may be up to states or the federal government to decide if computer-driven cars still need manual controls or a licensed driver in the vehicle. Whalen says regulators should work with developers to figure this out.
We're going to have a larger conversation about what are the issues with driverless cars and what should government's role be in regulating their use. But I hope that we can do that in partnership with Google and the other developers of the technology.
Whalen says reaction to the project from the community has been largely positive. The Kirkland mayor also says driverless cars could be useful in transportation for people with mobility issues, such as her 98-year-old grandmother.
One of the advantages of having them in your community is you start to think, this could work for my grandmother. This could work for me. You see the future happening in your community. It's pretty exciting.
The autonomous fleet has logged over 1.5 million miles in Kirkland and three other cities around the country since the project began in 2009, according to Google's April report on the project.
Ah!
You're listening to The Bridge. Northwest Whale Watch Tour operators are concerned about something they're seeing out in the water, people flying drones too close to protected killer whales. Correspondent Tom Bonsi reports the rules in this area are not as clear as law enforcement would like.
Boats have to stay 200 yards away from our endangered resident killer whales, no question about that. But what if one of those boaters launches an aerial drone to take better pictures from closer up? It's not a theoretical question. Michael Harris directs the Pacific Whale Watching Association.
We have seen hobby drones being flown out there. We've seen them being flown egregiously close to protected whales.
Harris worries about disturbance or even a dying battery leading to a drone versus whale crash.
We don't need that out there. You know, we need to reduce the stress on these whales.
Washington Fish and Wildlife Police ticketed two drone operators last year, but the first guy contested his $1,000 citation and it was dismissed on appeal this spring. That prompted San Juan County Prosecutor Randy Gaylord to request a state attorney general's opinion about whether aircraft are covered by existing orca protection rules. I'm Tom Bonsi reporting.
According to Gaylord, the statute wasn't written with drones in mind. It's an emerging area. The prosecutor said an additional complication is that the Federal Aviation Administration is asserting jurisdiction over drone regulation as states and cities, for various reasons, seek to regulate drones, also known as unmanned aerial vehicles. The FAA has not taken a position on this particular whale disturbance angle. Gaylord said Washington state rules are most likely to be enforced because sheriff's deputies and state wildlife officers perform the vast majority of patrols. Whale scientists have used drones to photograph northwest killer whales. The researchers involved in this work said they flew about 100 feet overhead after getting multiple permits from the United States and Canadian governments. Vancouver Aquarium marine mammal scientist Lance Barnett Leonard said last fall he didn't think the whales noticed the little buzzing hexacopter. That's a 6-rotor battery-powered unmanned helicopter at that far distance. Drones are good for research but should not be part of the whale-watching experience, Harris asserts. He says he favors the imposition of a moratorium on amateur drones flying over whales. For much of this winter, residents of Ashland in southern Oregon have heard the daily chop, chop, chop of helicopters making hundreds of trips over the hills just outside town. It's part of a project to thin the nearby forest of smaller trees and brush that could fuel a destructive wildfire. In keeping with the goal of ecosystem restoration, foresters are using the helicopter to remove cut timber rather than dragging fallen trees across the forest floor. From Jefferson Public Radio, Bill McLean reports. A new federal survey confirms that beekeepers lost 28% of their colonies last winter after losses of 22% the previous year. The survey results are in keeping with a larger trend that started a decade ago when bee numbers began to fall dramatically. Dr. Dewey Caron, a professor at Oregon State University, says the decrease in bees is in part because of the relatively new syndrome known as colony collapse disorder.
Doing the autopsy of the dead colonies, we saw a different series of characteristics, and it was different enough that we then coined a different term.
In just 13 months, from April 2015 to March of this year, the survey says 44% of bee colonies nationwide were lost. Conducted in partnership with the USDA, it concluded both large and small-scale beekeeping operations. Caron says the Pacific Northwest results aren't back yet, but preliminary numbers are similar to the national trend. There are a number of reasons for the losses, according to Karen. Mites have become a big source of decline for bee colonies and are the most likely culprit in the majority of survey cases. The use of pesticides continues to be a persistent problem, and Karen says the growing numbers of backyard beekeepers are hobbyists who face a steep learning curve managing bees for the first time.
There's a lot of new individuals not getting the same messages on how to more effectively control the mite, for example, how to more effectively protect their bees from pesticide damage.
Dr. Karen goes on to explain that ineffective treatment against the mite can lead to its spread, creating a chain of collapse. The killer parasite has also had a severe effect on beekeepers' large-scale income-producing operations. You can find out more about this important topic this evening at 7 p.m. at the Fort George Lovell Showroom at 1483 Duane Street in Astoria. The Nature Matters Speaker Series presents The Iconic Bumblebee, The Decline of Our Native Pollinator, with Richard Hatfield. The Bureau of Land Management's proposed changes to forest protection in western Oregon could affect the 100-year Northwest Forest Plan set up for the region more than two decades ago. Conservation groups are comparing the current proposal to a similar revision in 2008, which was ultimately struck down by a federal judge in 2012. Those groups filed a protest this week against the Bureau of Land Management's latest proposal to change the forest management in western Oregon. The BLM's revision eliminates some of the protections against logging near streams and could put the state out of step with the Northwest Forest Plan, the 100-year plan coordinated with Washington State and California. Susan Brown is an attorney with the Western Environmental Law Center, which filed the protest on behalf of 22 conservation groups.
Our concern there is that by essentially pulling out of a range-wide regional plan, the BLM is leaving a huge hole in conservation and protection on those federal lands, and that may have all kinds of repercussions.
The Northwest Forest Plan was adopted in 1994. If the BLM moves ahead with its revisions, 2.6 million acres of land would be removed from the regional plan. Brown says the Northwest Forest Plan faced a similar challenge in 2008 when the BLM proposed the Western Oregon Plan revision, which would have increased logging on BML-managed lands. A federal judge declared the revised plan illegal in 2012. Brown says the newest proposal feels like a rehash of the last unsuccessful revision.
We seem to be having these conversations over and over again, and I wish that there was a more proactive attempt to really try to manage these lands in a way that would work for more of the public than what the BLM is attempting to do now.
The conservation group's protests say the BLM's newest plan reduces the buffer zone between logging activities and streams in certain areas, which could threaten water quality and wildlife. Summer marks the 100th anniversary of the National Park Service. A coalition of civil rights and conservation groups is calling for public lands to be more inclusive over the next century. The coalition has started a petition urging President Obama to issue an executive order to make public lands more diverse. Maid Arce, president of the Hispanic Access Foundation, says the coalition has the legacy of public lands in mind with this petition.
Our work here as a coalition is to challenge this president and also our next president to really embrace a vision for the next century of conservation that focuses on the importance of national parks and public lands for all Americans, with emphasis on all.
She says President Obama has already led the way by offering free access to national parks to every fourth grader and their families, and working with Native American communities to address concerns about copper mining. Arce says hiring a diverse workforce in order to hear from diverse voices is key to making public lands more inclusive.
There's always been, for many years, a discussion about the difficulty in reaching diverse communities, but without those individuals working on these lands and for our parks, it's really going to be difficult to develop programming that reaches and engages different populations.
Shantha Reddy Alonso heads Creation Justice Ministries, an environmental justice group that represents major Christian denominations. She thinks there should be more protections for the sacred parts of our public lands.
Right now, too many places where there are petroglyphs or we know that there are graves are being ravaged and disturbed because they're underprotected and underrecognized. We would like to see more reverence for those types of places.
You can see the petition and policy recommendations at change.org. That's all we have time for on this edition of The Bridge. If you missed any part of it or just want to hear it again, it is available as a podcast on our website at coastradio.org. We like hearing from you. Email questions or comments to News One. That's NEWS and the numeral 1 at KMUN.org. And you can like us on Facebook. I'm Kate Brister. Thank you for listening, and join us next time on The Bridge. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.